Welcome to RHRealityTech.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, Irene Carmon will be on to discuss the year in choice politics. The Plan B fallout continues, and it turns out that the sexting hysteria was built on nothing. From the Truth is Stranger Than Fiction file comes this story out of New Zealand.
Bill Johnson is a former Alabama governor, or candidate for governor, and he is still doing politics in the state of Alabama. However, he's in the news today because of the fact that he was donating sperm to lesbian couples in New Zealand.
When?
Without telling his wife about it.
Loss.
So his wife has just found out about it. She says that their family has a lot of healing to do. She's obviously a little disappointed about it.
Regular listeners will not be surprised to find out that Johnson is a conservative Christian who rails against same-sex marriage, amongst other things. Apparently, donating sperm is something of a sexual fetish for a small group of men. I would not be surprised if conservative Christians are overrepresented in that group of fetishists. The fallout continues from the Obama administration throwing the finger to science and women's health care concerns by refusing to allow the FDA to make Plan B emergency contraception over-the-counter to all without age restrictions. Most mainstream media coverage of this story has been cursory. I can see why. We're in an economic recession, election season is about to start, and these are dark times. It's hard to work this story into the news cycle. But the problem with giving the story only cursory attention is that it's a really complex story. Audiences know pretty much nothing about it. Many think, incorrectly, that emergency contraception is like an abortion when it works actually by preventing ovulation. Many people incorrectly think it's more dangerous than it is, or that it encourages teen sexual activity. In addition, there's concerns about the administration overstepping their bounds. There was the outrageous sexism and the pandering. Lots to cover. So I was happy to see Chris Hayes host a roundtable on the issue on MSNBC, with Rebecca Traister, who is always the best. Rebecca went right after President Obama for his, "Gosh darn, I don't want my daughters buying Plan B," nonsense.
It's an incredibly paternalistic thing to say. I mean, when you're talking about a public health decision, public health policy, to say, as the father of two daughters, I know best. And what's more, the addition of the, it's just common, we need to apply some common sense. The idea that as the father and, you know, the protector of the good health and well-being of his two daughters, Obama is applying common sense in opposition to the people on the other side of the decision. The idea that the battle that they're fighting, which is to make more forms of contraceptives, a scientifically supported form of contraception available to more women.
Right.
That's not common sense, that it's irresponsible, that it's whimsical, and that by dint of his paternity, he has some moral authority that is greater than those scientists and activists on the other side of the issue, is unbelievably paternalistic, condescending, and it takes what is a scientific and perhaps, yes, a political debate and resituates it in this kind of familial realm that is really offensive.
There's no doubt that sort of language resonates with much of America. The notion that teenage girls are basically property and that if they have sex, they are somehow broken is pervasive in America. It's one of those beliefs that's beyond reason in a very direct way. We believe this even though we were all teenagers once, and we all know from experience that teenagers aren't children who can't make basic decisions for themselves. We also know that the horrific double standard that allows boys to be sexual but shames and punishes girls for the same is wrong. But we don't care. Logic doesn't penetrate. But for those of us who aren't engaged in the national hysteria about teen pregnancy, Obama's condescending statements were crystal clear and incredibly sexist. Believe it or not, it was Elise Jordan, who was a speechwriter for Condoleezza Rice, who actually pointed out that Obama was simply being dishonest when he tried to scare Americans with images of 11-year-olds having sex.
And so
it was so misleading because it's I think it's like 1% of 11-year-olds and are sexually active. Right. And so by invoking 10-year-olds and 11-year-olds, he really played to that.
And the question of sexuality, it's very obvious that this is what he was communicating with. Communicating was a discomfort with the idea of young women's sexuality. We need to apply common sense. And it totally takes away from the reality of what we're talking about when we're talking about this drug, which is a post-facto contraceptive. This is not, and it costs between $30 and $50. I saw somebody $70. It is a very expensive one-time drug. This is not something that young women are going to be stockpiling to, you know, so that they can go out and have, you know, this is not activating a sex life, right? So that in bringing the conversation again back to what is clearly an obvious discomfort about sexuality and young women, he's completely altering it in not only flying in the face of scientific evidence and the scientific argument presented by the FDA, but also the very nature of what we're talking about when we talk about emergency contraception. He's completely mangling it.
Exactly. What's been incredibly frustrating about this is that it continues to be assumed that this will somehow give you permission for sex. That is literally the dumbest thing I can think of, and not just because there's no scientific data to show that it is an effect. It's because we already have a contraception that's much cheaper and more effective and sold over the counter. It's called, you know, condoms. In fact, condoms are the favorite contraception of teenagers for that reason, which is a good thing. They should be using condoms. It couldn't be more obvious that the anxiety about this is strictly due to the fact that girls and girls alone control Plan B. I've seen people stretch and claim that this is bad because maybe some boy won't use a condom sometime. But again, the price and convenience issues really negate that argument. But it is true that this could spare a girl who has the misfortune to sleep with a cat who slips the condom off. I fail to see in what universe that would be a bad thing. Hayes then brought Dr. Susan Wood on. Dr. Wood resigned from the FDA after the Bush administration blocked Plan B from over-the-counter sales for political reasons. She explained why Secretary Kathleen Sebelius has set a horrible precedent.
As far as I'm aware, and as far as anyone I've known is aware, this is unprecedented. And unfortunately, it sets a precedent for possibly a future secretary, say a Secretary Tom Coburn, to take a look at decisions that the FDA makes about all kinds of products and say he doesn't feel comfortable with that decision and overturning, say, an AIDS preventive product or a anything related to abortion or sexual health or vaccines. There could be all kinds of trouble that could be created in the future by this precedent.
And all the fur over this, that has been the least discussed and most troubling aspect. The Obama administration has basically stripped away the last protections that our various agencies have from having politics dictate all decisions. Eventually, there will be another conservative Republican in office. Now that the last pretense that officials should put doing a good job ahead of politics has been stripped away, now what? EPA officials being told that there's no such thing as pollution? The Department of Education being told to mandate creationism in classrooms? This is a very serious precedent. Dr. Wood also demolished the whole argument that this decision does anything but make it very hard for those who need it to get Plan B.
One thing I'd want to point out is that the question about safety and common sense, again, that's something that the FDA physicians and scientists considered. But I actually went out looking for some emergency contraception last night to look at the safety label itself. And I don't know if you can see it, but this product, it cost me $50. And I had to go to three different pharmacies to get it. And when I found a pharmacy that was open, I couldn't believe it. They asked me for my ID. Right. To make sure I was over 17, I tried to take that as a compliment. and you get for it, you get this one pill, just one, and it costs $50, and it's very, very safe. It has only one safety comment on it, which is don't take it if you're already pregnant because it will not work.
She then goes on to compare it to chewable, bubblegum-flavored Tylenol, which has tons of warnings, costs a fraction as much, and comes with 24 pills in a packet, meaning that it would actually be possible to overdose and die, unlike with Plan B. The notion that there's a single concern about the physical safety of girls because of this is just a plain lie. There was a ton of goodness in this roundtable that I don't have time to get to, such as when Hayes played a clip of Obama promising to put scientific information in front of political considerations, a promise that he thoroughly broke here. So seriously, check out the link in show notes and watch the whole thing. I'd like to welcome Irene Carmone to the program. Irene is a journalist who works for Salon, and she recently published what amounts to a roundup of what happened in 2011 in the world of reproductive rights. It was a crazy year, as podcast listeners know, so Irene is coming on to break it down for us. Welcome to RealityCast, Irene.
Thanks, Amanda.
Okay, I think it's undeniable, of course, that early 2011 was like a dizzying array of assaults on reproductive rights, both on a state and federal level. But despite the escalation in the war over reproductive rights, you feel that there's like no way to really declare a winner. Why do you say that?
Well, you know, when you're sort of looking at each of these state laws incrementally, it's easy to feel a great amount of despair when you see the fact that Republicans and the anti-choice groups that are working with them are getting so audacious in certain states about the restrictions that they're putting on women who are seeking abortion care. But, you know, and a lot of that happened, of course, because you had these Republican-dominated state houses in the midterm elections in 2010. They got in January, and they immediately went to work on uteruses of all of the sort of pressing issues of our day. They focused on limiting women's rights. But it was interesting to see that as the sort of year wore on, the judiciary did what it was supposed to do, which is to say, hold on, you know, many of these laws are unconstitutional. Pretty much every law that the pro-choice litigants took to court, they managed to get blocked, with, I think, one exception in South Dakota, which was only partially upheld. So as much as they haven't picked every battle, and as much as, you know, this is still playing defense, you have a situation where, at the very least, the basic parameters of women's rights are being defended in the courts. It's not happy news. Obviously, you know, if we had the resources preventing unwanted pregnancies in the first place or providing health care to women, that would be great. But at least we can say that even Republican judges stepped up to the plate and said this is totally unconstitutional.
Personally, I mean, I agree with you, obviously, that it was like a whole bunch of terrible stuff happened, and then it kind of got a little bit better. But I do feel that on the whole, like, science and facts were like the real losers of the year. And you discussed this in some detail in your article on two fronts. It's the, first of all, you have these fetal pain laws, and then you also have the battle over personhood amendments and what that would mean in terms of hormonal contraception. Can you elaborate on the question of the role of scientific misinformation in the reproductive rights fight in 2011?
Well, I mean, the problem is if science were the ultimate arbiter, we wouldn't even be having this kind of conversation, right? I mean, if this were just purely based on the principles of medical information, then we wouldn't even be worrying about these laws. But unfortunately, the way that they're playing out in the public stage is totally different. So when it comes to the personhood amendment, of course, they are obsessed with saying that a fertilized egg that hasn't even implanted in the womb is a person. You know, they got very close to passing it in Mississippi, and they've managed to get each of the presidential Republican candidates who are vying for the nomination to weigh in on whether it is a person if it's implanted in the uterus or not. So in Mississippi, of course, this was not even, you know, the sadly under low information voters of Mississippi, relatively speaking, knew that this was completely ridiculous and feared what it meant for their birth control and their reproductive technologies and, to some extent, their access to abortion. So that was a bullet that was dodged, but you did have 42% of the electorate in Mississippi. You know, Linda Greenhouse in my piece calls this "take your fertilized egg to the prom." I mean, it has no basis in sort of the medical definition of pregnancy, and to then create policy from it is kind of the next stage of madness. Unfortunately, when it comes to the most important justice on the Supreme Court for ensuring reproductive rights, and that's what, unfortunately, it's come down to in some, like, long-range picture, he isn't interested in scientific information either, at least not universally or consistently. So I think everybody was pretty spooked in the second Carhartt decision in 2007 when you suddenly have, you know, obviously anti-choices are trying whatever sticks, they're throwing anything at the wall, and their favorite thing at that point, and this informs a lot of these really ridiculous laws, as you know, a woman being protected from her own decisions, a woman feeling great regret at her abortion. So, you know, and for whatever reason, this was something that Anthony Kennedy was willing to look at in the amicus brief, even though he himself said there was no evidence. So if he's previously said, you know, if he's previously said, while we can find no evidence that most women regret their abortions, I think it's true, or it seems unexceptionable. So that just sets, you know, you talk about precedent, that sets kind of a scary precedent, because you're saying, well, although we find no evidence that, you know, women's fathers need to make their decisions for them, or whatever it is, you know, it's just this kind of slippery slope where you're departing from medical or sociological reality, which is why I think the fetal pain laws, which are based in no medical evidence, I mean, they're based on sort of this idea that the fetus recoils, but before 20 weeks, there isn't consciousness, so you have, like, this Zen question, and you also have, you know, sort of no constitutional thing that we have to, like, be limiting pain in the first place. But let's just say, even just on the basis of science, these six states that have enacted fetal pain bans are doing so based on kind of made-up science. The worry is, you know, if he wasn't worried about science before, would Anthony Kennedy be concerned that these fetal pain laws have nothing to do with what is actually happening inside the uterus and still consider that vague claim more important than the woman's right?
Yeah, and I mean, I think this is something I've tried to hammer at a little on the show, is this whole notion that science is not as important in a legal way as people, I think, hope that it is. And I'm glad that the Mississippi voters saw that. And in the whole Mississippi situation, one of the things, it was kind of the culmination of a long year of something that I found really fascinating in 2011. It was the year that the anti-choice activist movement decided to really start a more formal war on contraception. I mean, they've always kind of objected to contraception, but they've kept that on the sort of down low. And this year it was like the next level. With the attack on Planned Parenthood's contraception funding, this personhood amendment in Mississippi, they just seemed a lot more out about it. Why do you think that was?
Well, I think that they're getting emboldened by how much they've gotten away with so far. And to go back to your point about misinformation, I mean, and this was really interesting to see on the ground in Mississippi. In order to understand why these laws are bullshit, you kind of have to understand a lot about human reproduction, right? You have to understand the difference between fertilization and implantation, and the way different contraceptives work, and so you know, what ends up happening is that in Mississippi, for example, you had to kind of reinvent the wheel every time and say, like, this is how pregnancy works, this is how your body works, and we're talking about a state where, you know, it's on the books in Mississippi that it's abstinence only, or the school board can opt into abstinence plus, but under no circumstances can you ever demonstrate how a condom works. You know, so these things are obviously deeply related, as you know. If you have a situation where people don't understand how their bodies work, they're easily opened up to these sorts of hysterical, slippery slope arguments about how the birth control pill is the same thing as abortion. So once you have the sort of emotional or religious manipulation happening about reproduction, then kind of anything is possible. And I feel like they were emboldened this year to show, particularly, you know, there's the scientific conflation of the birth control, of various forms of birth control and abortion, right, when they try to claim, if you ask any of these people in the personhood movement and many people in the sort of quote-unquote mainstream anti-choice movement, if you ask them about the morning after pill, they'll answer you by talking about RU-486. I mean, it's like they've been trained. And so, and we both know that that's not the same thing at all. One of them prevents the pregnancy, one of them ends the pregnancy. But as long as they can keep saying that and people don't really understand how they work, they can sort of throw in their, you know, their anti-birth control mission. And, I mean, when you start having things like defunding Planned Parenthood in a bunch of different states, but they're just talking about how Planned Parenthood is the biggest abortion provider in the world and, you know, wants to kill your babies, well, you know, that was a bridge too far, because it turns out that there's lots of people who know full well that Planned Parenthood is like what gave them their birth control when they were a poor student. Well, and that, it feels like they tried to get away with that this year, but they were wrong.
Yeah, that's one of the things I thought was really interesting in your article. You basically felt like they may have like lost quite a few rhetorical points by going there. Do you think that they might, that it was just a clean loss for them on that, or do you think that they may have muddied the waters at all?
You mean with personhood and birth control?
With the attacks on contraception from Planned Parenthood to the Personhood Amendment.
You know, it would be interesting to see how much, I mean, beyond people who are paying attention, how much people realize. I mean, I think you're right that we have to keep pointing out the real hostilities here, because it's possible that people still aren't, it sort of isn't getting through to the average person what the real agenda is here. But they, I mean, when they almost shut down the government earlier this year, the federal government, over defunding Planned Parenthood, I mean, it was kind of, I didn't make it into the piece, but, you know, when I was talking to people from Planned Parenthood, they basically said, like, we, you know, this is self-referential, but the thing that we think is the most ridiculous statement that sums up the year is not intended to be a factual statement, right? If you have, you have John Kyle talking about how, like, what is it, 96% of what Planned Parenthood does is provide abortions. Well, obviously the vast majority of what Planned Parenthood does is women's health services that don't relate to abortion. And so, you know, again, not intended to be a factual statement, could have really summed up the entire attitude towards women's reproduction that the anti-choice people brought out more blatantly than ever this year.
Irene's piece was published on December 4th, and it's titled, Who's Winning the Abortion War? You can read that piece and many other pieces of her excellent journalism at Salon. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Irene.
Thank you so much, Amanda. I got love for you if you were born in the
80s. In the past couple of years, I'm sure you've been subjected to the moral panic over sexting, which is one of those words that is designed to make ordinary behavior seem way more scandalous than it is. The theory is that there's a rash of horny teenagers sending naked pictures of themselves to each other, and eventually the world will be so awash in naked pictures of high schoolers that civilization itself will collapse. As moral panics go, it rated below hysteria over Elvis Presley swiveling his hips, but above claims that kids were exchanging slap bracelets for oral sex. The whole panic was fueled by suspicions that everyone who had gone through puberty but couldn't vote yet was doing this. Well, surprise, surprise, perhaps the panic was a little bit too panicked.
Well, a new study out this morning finds that teen sexting may not be as common as some people feared. Researchers found that only 1% of children in the U.S. ages 10 to 17 have shared nude photos. 7% of them say they had received graphic or suggestive images. Researchers say parents should not panic over teen sexting because it's not rampant or malicious.
Oh boy, a whole 30 seconds spent by the early show correcting the record. After months of heavy-handed stories about the evils of sexting and how your teenage daughter is probably sending every boy in school pictures of her vagina right this second, I feel like it needs a little more in terms of a rebuttal. For instance, they didn't discuss the details, such as pointing out that most of the kids who had sent or received suggestive texts or pictures were either just talking or sending porn they got from somewhere else. Not ideal, I guess. But if seeing dirty pictures before you turn 18 was ruinous for kids, my entire generation would be a waste. I think it's wise to tell your kids about the potential ramifications of sending naked pictures of themselves around on phones, but let's be clear. The more you panic about it, the more dangerous and rebellious the behavior seems, and thus the more likely kids are to do it. So it's wise not to blow this out of proportion. Compare that calm, reasonable, and let me remind you, short, correction to the record with the coverage of sexting from a couple of years ago when the panic first began.
Police in Vermont have broken up a sexting ring involving nearly 24 teenagers. The girls involved, some as young as 14, took pictures and videos of themselves and sent them to several boys. Two of those boys used school-issued laptops to distribute those images. There are no current criminal charges being held on this, but the teens are going to have a tough sit-down, though, with local authorities.
Not just sexting, but a sexting ring. You know, like a drug ring or a prostitution ring. We don't usually use the word ring to mean non-criminal or normal behavior. No one ever says, today a YouTube swapping ring was discovered in Boston, Massachusetts, with as many as 20 individuals implicated in a plot to swap cat videos and jokes from Funny or Die. Or compare the calm rebuttal to Elizabeth Hasselbeck's report on sexting, which is about as calm and rational as she usually is, which is never.
Sat down with seven teenagers from the age of 15 to 18 and asked them about sexting, you know, be it videos that are explicit or pictures. And I asked them all, show of hands, how many of them have been asked to send an explicit photo or video of themselves. I was shocked. Every hand went up.
Really?
It was common. I mean, what is going on what's going on right now with these teens is that they're being asked to do it. And we've seen in New Jersey now, there was just a piece of legislation that was passed that actually will prevent them from being sex offenders if they do pass it on. Which a lot of parents, interestingly enough, don't want this criminalized because it handcuffs them in terms of helping their teens who are then bullied because of the sexting.
Surprising that a parent wouldn't want their kid thrown in jail because they were an awkward adolescent engaging in a little thoughtless flirtation. And gosh, do you think the nonstop coverage of... TV coverage claiming that all teenagers are making at-home pornography might have some relationship to the readiness of teenage boys to ask for these pictures? I mean, if you're a teenage boy and the news tells you that literally all of your classmates are getting naked pictures of girls sent to them on their phone, it's just a matter of time before you start making requests of your own. It's not cool, but that's how our teenage boys are socialized. Instead of making sexuality the villain, how about thinking long and hard about how it is we teach our boys to treat girls with so little respect and dignity? Instead of worrying that girls are sexual, why aren't we worrying that boys take intimate moments and use them to gain bragging rights with their friends at the expense of their girlfriends? Anyway, it seems from the polling that girls aren't so very stupid as the media would have you believe, and kids aren't so very crazy. So with that, I'll leave you with an excellent moment from last year's Saturday Night Live.
Good evening, I'm Wanda Ramirez, and we begin tonight's program, as we always do, with a story designed to frighten parents. We told you about sexting, huffing, and robo-tripping, and now there's yet another dangerous teenage fad. Our own Peter DeSantos has the story.
They call it souping. Teenagers are drinking expired soup cans to get high. Every teenager is doing it, and it will kill them. Parents are powerless to protect their teens because, shockingly, soup is legal.
And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, your sexual fantasies simply aren't reality edition. O'Reilly, like many conservatives, really doesn't understand that gay is a sexual orientation and not a free license to rub loofahs on whoever you want to in front of the children. A little boy confronted Michelle Bachmann about gay marriage recently because his mom is gay, and O'Reilly, he's angry about that.
Far beyond their understanding. An eight-year-old doesn't know what homosexuality is.
Yes, they do.
Nor should he or she.
Yes, no, they don't.
They don't. They don't know or understand what it is. They may know the term, they may know that mom or dad are different, okay? But they don't understand it. They're not emotionally equipped to understand it.
O'Reilly thinks an eight-year-old is roughly as smart as a preverbal infant then. When I was eight, if you had asked me if my mom liked boys or girls, I'm pretty certain I could give you an answer on that. I understood heterosexuality perfectly well since straight people were flaunting it all the time with their hand-holding and their weddings and their kisses and whatnot. The reality is that kids understand sexual orientation just fine. They don't necessarily understand sex, maybe, but they understand love and affection and preference perfectly well. The only reason to doubt that is if you can't look at gay people without thinking about the sex they're having. But kids and mature adults can get past that. It's only weirdos like O'Reilly who can't.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.